Broadcasting live from the Buckhead Business Radio X studios in Atlanta, Georgia, it's time for Atlanta Legal Experts.
Good morning and welcome to another exciting episode of Atlanta Legal Experts. I am your host, Emily Rowell with Peachtree Offices, and I have Rich Casanova with Buckhead Business Radio X. Good morning.
Here? I feel like I'm in class already. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm here. This is going to be an exciting episode where we have some great guests this morning.
Yes, yeah. And a lot of hot topics.
Yep.
So we're excited. So continue to listen. We have Diane Weinberg with Morgan & DeSalvo, PC. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. Thank you for being here. And Sarah Crossman Sullivan with SeeItFit.com.
Good morning.
Both of these guests have been highly recommended, so we're really excited about this show. And we will start with Sarah Crossman Sullivan. She is a corporate consultant, attorney, and entrepreneur with a growing national presence, featured on NBC, Fox News Network, The Layman's Lawyer, Entrepreneur, and The Wall Street Journal. Sarah's ease in courtrooms.
And Atlanta Business Radio. You forgot to add that one, yeah.
Atlanta Business Radio. Sorry. The Wall Street Journal, Sarah's ease in courtrooms and boardrooms resonates. She brings 18 years of experience as a CEO, labor and employment law attorney, prosecutor and healthcare advocate to her current role as co-founder and co-CEO of SeeItFit.com. As a frequent national speaker and writer on leadership, innovation, and inspiration, Sarah contributes to Entrepreneur.com, Success Magazine, Your Whole Life, Better You Network, Biz Buzz Radio, Beyond Motherhood and Smart Business, and Atlanta Legal Experts.
There you go. Nice.
She is a mother of four children and provides engaging, practical insights on work, life, faith, and family. Wow.
Are you exhausted?
I am. I don't know how you do it.
Let's all take a break now, yeah.
So thank you for being here.
It's an honor to be with you all.
We have some really cool topics to talk about today. Where is Atticus Finch? Please tell me.
Oh my! I'm still looking for him. I mean, if a lot of lawyers are like me, you fell in love with To Kill a Mockingbird, and then you begin your practice. Whether you're a prosecutor and loving the courtroom, or you're a mediator, or any shade of the vast array of legal opportunities. But you jump in and often find billing every 6 minutes, those late hours, an inability to perhaps see friends and family as much as you would like, and you find that it's perhaps not what you thought it would be. Certainly not a Matthew McConaughey movie and not like a favorite book you read.
Right. So what do you do when being a lawyer is not all you hoped it would be?
I think the first thing you need to do is determine what other outlets you have. Meaning before you decide to make the leap and completely get out of the profession, see if there are some volunteer opportunities that will help you grow and glow and figure out exactly what you really desire to do. You know, I think too often we talk about go out and find your passion. And that's a great tagline, but it's not easy to do. Because right. If you knew your passion, you'd probably be happy in your current job.
Right. Right. And I know there's a lot of service providers for attorneys that could help them as well, just take the load off so that they're able to do what they're passionate about as well.
That's right. And I think attorneys, too, feel a little pigeonholed and boxed in, meaning they've gone to 3 years of school, have gotten their Juris Doctorate, 3 years beyond their undergraduate degree, and now think, well, a lawyer is all I can do. Mm-hmm. And boy, do we need to change that dialogue, because there is so much you can do. Mm-hmm. In fact, I often tell young adults, especially women, if you feel at all the desire to go to law school, do it. Because once you have that law degree, no one can take it from you, and there is so much good you can do not practicing traditional law.
Oh, wow. That's awesome. I'd love to hear more. I'm excited. How do you transition to another career?
Well, you certainly do so carefully. And what I mean by that is whether you are transitioning from practicing traditional law or a corporate job, you know, if you're the CMO of a company, that first jumping off point is the biggest leap. So you want to do so with a lot of information because it's a powerful point and you don't want to leap off and find the next job is troublesome or you're disappointed.
Right.
So it's very, very important to educate yourself, talk to a lot of folks, consider all your options. And at that moment, as well as other stages in life, surround yourself with good people who hold you accountable, people who you can be authentic with and who'll give you great salient advice on how to best go forward.
That's so important. I mean, the support is huge. And if you're waking up every morning and you absolutely love with what you do, then it's not, you're not dragging and you're not the, you know, doing just the day to day with, you know, oh, just a negative attitude. You're doing it with joy.
Yes.
And then when you have the support of the people around you, then it even makes it better.
That's right. You know, it's very interesting. There was just a feature last night on ESPN on Jets wide receiver David Nelson, who really talked about, as an NFL player, leading somewhat of a selfish life. And it wasn't until a trip to Haiti where he learned to lead a life of love. Mm. And so it's amazing to hear this incredible NFL player who's got it all, who says, no, my all comes from these children who now are my family in Haiti.
Wow. That's awesome. You are a writer, a speaker, consultant, and entrepreneur. I can't even say that without taking a deep breath. Did law school or a legal career prepare you for these career changes, or have these endeavors been a part of your dream?
The answer would be yes and both. That law school, again, enhances those skill sets, especially if you reach out to opportunities. In law school, I was very, very active in moot court and trial advocacy, won several of those competitions, but also in writing, being enveloped and surrounded by people who want to cause you to be a better writer. Mm-hmm. One of the first bosses I had as an attorney, oh my gosh, he was so tough. Louis Sapp, I love you at Ellerby Thompson. But I remember one time I wrote a brief for him and I thought I did such a great job, and he came into my office, handed it to me, and he had one mark on it for one change. And we had a conversation about that because he said, I know you did a good job here, but I want you to do the best job you possibly can. Mm-hmm. And so I was so grateful for him for caring enough to spot that one error, mm-hmm. and bring out the best in me.
So how did you decide you wanted to be a speaker and a consultant, if you don't mind me asking?
Not at all. To be quite candid, I was raised by a wonderful daddy who is a brilliant Methodist minister and a mom who was a corporate consultant. So lots of speaking and advocacy in my household.
Sure.
And, you know, let's be honest, the best way I found to find out who you are called to be is through a lot of prayer. Mm. And so that's really helped, being surrounded by prayer my whole life and also practicing it daily.
Wow, that's awesome. And I can tell she's just a little bit motivating. What do you think?
Well, I don't know if this applies, but you often hear like the best way to learn is by teaching, right? So the more you engage with an audience or speak on a subject, probably the more...
Agreed.
Right? Mm-hmm. More, mm-hmm. Your awareness goes up as well, right?
Yes, and don't you find it interesting? I'm sure you all experience this, that when you are called to speak, but when you allow others to speak to you and you do a lot more listening, you learn so much more.
Oh, I'm telling
you.
We say that almost, I think about that every week during a show. It's like, it's just amazing, the collection of folks that come through the studio, and it's like, it's like being in class every week. You learn so much from some other people, and they're not, there's a life experience, but also just what they've done, their accomplishments, and you know, there's a takeaway, an aha moment from every show. Mm-hmm. At least, yeah.
So tell me, can you still practice law while cultivating passions?
Absolutely. And I really encourage it. I think oftentimes when people are in a frustrating situation, they just want to sort of cut it out, mm-hmm. maybe inadvertently burn some bridges. And mm-hmm. I advise, don't do it. You never know when the law is going to come back. Mm-hmm. And I will tell you candidly that even though right now in my life, I am the co-founder of a fantastic startup called See It Fit, I still get those 2 a.m. calls from family members and from friends who are in crisis, and I want to be able to help. It's very important for me to maintain my license, maintain my legal education, mm-hmm. so I can continue to hopefully be the best advocate that I can be.
That's fantastic. Is volunteer work helpful?
Oh, heavens, absolutely yes. Not only does it help you in finding who you want to be and who God calls you to be, but also, let's face it, when we're in the hole, when we're feeling bad, one of the best ways to get yourself out of that hole and to feel better is to serve others.
Sure. To forget about yourself.
Yes.
Absolutely. How do you distinguish whether it's the legal career making you weary versus your present work environment?
or maybe both. We lawyers have such a stellar reputation, don't we? Oh my gosh. Well,
that's why we have the show.
That's right. That's right. Which is really fantastic, because we need to think about the fact, are we attorneys part of the problem in this reputation that we have? Mm-hmm. You know, Emily, you and I have talked about the fact that I often say law school doesn't make people jerks. or you know, right. big pains in the necks. Sometimes those folks come to law school. Right. And so what are we fostering? And so I think it's really important to consider, you know, maybe you're just in a bad office environment and it's a bad structure, but it doesn't mean it's bad to be an attorney. Sure. So I would first think about that, because there are always good people out there.
Mm-hmm. And then always to reflect, I think, this is just my little input, to reflect on the good that you've done instead of thinking all the constantly about all the negative parts of the work that you do. You know, God, I got to do this, and I got to do this paperwork, and I got to do, you know, the, like I said earlier, the day-to-day grind, but just to think about the big picture more often and why you're doing it, and it probably keeps you out of that rut.
Yes, and who around you is helping you? You know, lawyers tend to have pretty good staffs around them. Mm-hmm. Is that legal assistant? Is that paralegal helping or hurting? And what are you doing to lift them up and thank them?
Mm-hmm. And sometimes people can be very toxic for you, so they can, you know, kind of bring you down.
You are the people you're surrounded by, right?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So tell me, does this advice hold true for any other career path as well as attorneys?
Absolutely. I found it to be true for anyone deciding to make a career transition. And, you know, study after study shows that some of the people who are happiest in life and finding the most joy have had multiple career paths. But mm-hmm. to do that, that means you've got to be willing to take some risk.
Sure.
And, you know, as Rich was talking about earlier, you know, people being around you who are authentic, that includes being authentic about their mistakes. You mm-hmm. can live a life of integrity and make some mistakes and have some falls, but right. it's all about how you get back up, all about how you face that fear.
I can't think about that. Who quoted the quote, but they said, if you haven't made a mistake, that means you haven't tried.
I tried hard enough, whatever. I haven't made enough mistakes.
Yeah. Right. Maybe Einstein. I don't remember. Sorry, I'm not quoting that right. One last question for you. You said earlier that if you would even thought about going to law school, to just go for it. You know, when you get out of school, you think high debt, and few job options. So tell me, is that really your recommendation to go to law school?
It absolutely is my recommendation, particularly because now more than ever, there are so many options for students. You don't have to go through in 3 years. You can go part-time and work. Mm-hmm. You can do some online courses, really do some creative things. Now, yes, there probably for most will be some debt, but mm-hmm. the work that you can do, as long as you are willing to work hard, can make an incredible difference in your life and, more importantly, the lives of others.
Gotcha. That's awesome. Do you have any announcements that you'd like to say on the show today?
What's up and coming, whatever, yeah.
I would love to make an announcement for all our fellow Atlanta lawyers out there that let's work together to make a change, particularly with continuing legal education courses. Mm-hmm. I have been approved by the bar to offer a brand new continuing legal education course that is no longer going to be rote subjects, but it's going to be inspirational subjects. How mm-hmm. do we find ourselves in our job? How do we feel better about being attorneys? How do we take work that has become perhaps tedious and taxing mm-hmm. and turn it into something that is incredibly rewarding? So if you'd like to know more, if you'd like to speak at this CLE, if you'd like to join us, please reach out to me on LinkedIn or on Twitter.
Okay, and that being said, if you'll give us all your contact information so whoever's listening can reach you.
Absolutely. On LinkedIn, it's simply Sarah Crossman Sullivan. That's Sarah with an H, S-A-R-A-H. Crossman is C-R-O-S-S-M-A-N Sullivan. That's LinkedIn, and it had to be abbreviated on Twitter. Twitter is Sarah Crossman Sue, so it's Sarah Crossman S-U. And I truly look forward to hearing from you, and we really can make a wonderful change.
That sounds great. It was such a pleasure having you, and stay tuned because we'll have some open discussion.
Yeah, I got a couple of questions or whatever afterwards during the open panel, yeah.
Sure. Okay. So keep on listening, and we welcome Diane. She's been so quiet and so sweet. Diane Weinberg, good morning.
Good morning.
And she is with Morgan and DeSalvo PC. She also came highly recommended and specializes in assisting families with the medical, financial, and housing-related legal challenges that often accompany aging and disability. Diane brings a unique, informed, and empathetic perspective to her clients. She offers compassionate and meaningful solutions to clients in the elder law area, including Medicaid and disability planning, veterans benefits counseling, guardianships and conservatorships, and special needs trusts. Currently, Diane serves as of counsel with the law firm of Morgan & DeSalvo, PC. She earned a BA at the University of Pennsylvania and her JD from the Emory University School of Law. She is a VA accredited attorney as well as AV rated attorney in Martindale Hubbell and rated a superb attorney on AVVO.com. Morgan & DeSalvo is ranked by U.S. News & World Report as the top law firm in the country in the area of trust and estates law. Outside of her law practice, Diane lives in Sandy Springs with her husband Mike and their three sons and a lab pitty mixed dog. In any remaining free time, Diane enjoys knitting and is a past treasurer of the Atlanta Knitting Guild. She also enjoys walking and has walked 2 half marathons for team and training for the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. Wow, that's another breathful there.
Walking marathon. Now, that's something I could do, whatever, yeah.
Exactly, these, not the running ones.
Yeah, 26Ks or whatever, yeah.
No, half marathons, okay. I'm not the fastest walker, so definitely a half and not a whole.
Well, I'll follow your lead or whatever, yeah.
Well, it sounds like you're doing what you love as well as practicing law.
Absolutely. It was funny because I'm terrible with names, I'm going to...
Sarah.
Thank you, Sarah. Because as Sarah was talking, and she was talking about how you start in one place in law thinking that you want to go, this is your path, mm-hmm. and you end up someplace very different. Mm-hmm. And so that was very much my path. I started out doing employee benefits work with a very large law firm and moved to railroad litigation of all things, which I absolutely, I loved. And then through, I walked into an interview and they said, there's a dead body on the tracks and we don't know whether or not the train hit it first or whether it was dead when the train hit it.
Or the body hit its first, whatever.
Yeah, exactly. And so I just thought that was so cool.
It is. It's like TV.
Exactly. But we did that for several years and through a whole series of events, which I won't go into in detail, but I ended up meeting with an elder law attorney and absolutely loved the practice and decided that this is what I wanted to devote my life to doing. And it is so rewarding to walk mm-hmm. in and to know that I have a personal contact, a personal impact mm-hmm. on each of my clients. I regularly get hugs from my clients. I remember early on when I first started doing this in 2005, I had a client and I didn't do a whole lot for them. They really just kind of need somebody to keep tabs on what was going on in a situation. And they not only paid my bill, which is a huge, of course, a deal for attorneys, right? But they wrote a thank you note and they enclosed the payment in the thank you note to letting me know how much they appreciated my service.
Wow.
And that was just... It's those little things that really mean a lot. So mm-hmm. I absolutely love what I do.
Talk about motivating.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Absolutely.
I was actually in the life insurance business in the past mm-hmm. for a couple of years. So I can kind of relate. And I worked with a special needs attorney as well as a financial, not financial planner. That's not an attorney, but a special needs and an elder law attorney as well. So it was so important, the communication we had between each other for our clients.
Exactly. Really, this is very much a team-type practice in that mm-hmm. you work sometimes with other attorneys, but often with financial planners, often with geriatric care managers, mm-hmm. Because you recognize that your client comes in and they have a host of problems.
Sure.
And I can resolve, if you will think of, and I'm doing a visual here, so I apologize. On the radio it goes really poorly. But, you think of a pie, and there's this whole series of problems, and I can deal with a slice of that problem.
Sure.
But I need to bring in my other resources, my housing resources, my care managers, my financial planners, so that we can really fix that person's problem and give them the best quality of life for as long as possible.
That's fantastic. So let's get to the questions. What exactly is elder law?
Yeah, I get that a lot. A lot of people refer to me as an elder care attorney, which is fine. I think that works as well. And I also think it's a terrible misnomer, and I really kind of wish they changed the name, because really what we do is long-term care planning. Mm-hmm. And I work with people with disabilities, and I work with people with disabilities really of all ages. I look at about the time they become adults until to the remainder of their life.
Mm-hmm.
So the same kind of planning techniques I might use for an 18-year-old who has autism, I would use for a 45-year-old who's had a stroke, or an 85-year-old who needs to go into a nursing home. There are definitely differences as far as nuances in the law as far as what strategies I'm going to employ, but
sure.
It's a lot of the same tactics. So mm-hmm. we really work with people with disabilities to provide for their long-term care.
Wow, that's fantastic. So what types of challenges cause someone to seek out the services of an elder law attorney? You named a couple, but if you could elaborate.
Absolutely. It's a crisis generally. I wish I could say I got more planning crises, but or more planning situations where somebody's coming in and anticipating that there might be this kind of problem. But typically I get the phone call from an adult child. It's actually kind of interesting because usually when you think of attorneys, you have your client who calls you. It's rarely my client who calls me. It's their adult children, and there's been something that has happened. There's been a diagnosis of Alzheimer's, or there's been a fall, and somebody's in a nursing home. Or again, I was thinking of a 45-year-old client that I have now who ended up in a nursing home, and the nursing home was applying for Medicaid, and they weren't sure how they were going to pay for their long-term care because they weren't qualifying for Medicaid at that point. So I get a phone call that somebody's got a crisis, and we've got to figure out how to finance that person's long-term care at that point, and deal with other situations that arise as well. Again, you get the 85-year-old who needs to go in a nursing home, and oh, by the way, they've been taking care of their 40-year-old Down syndrome child.
Oh, wow.
And so now what are we going to do for placement of this child and for providing for this child for the remainder of his life?
Right. Wow. Now, tell me this. Isn't it harder once you've already been in the situation to get the long-term care? And it's obviously easier to plan ahead, but can you tell me that a little bit more on that? Maybe, maybe not.
Not really.
No? Okay.
Not really. In some respects, it's easier because when somebody's in a crisis, if you will, your options are limited at that point. So it's pretty easy to figure out where we need to go and how to get there.
Okay.
So in some respects, crisis planning is a little bit easier just because you run out of options. It can be a little harder when somebody comes in and they say, my mom was just diagnosed with Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. We know a few things about Alzheimer's. We know that particularly in early diagnosis, you get somebody who's 65 or God forbid, we've seen it where you've got somebody with a diagnosis of dementia. I've got one client whose husband is 47.
Wow.
Mm. And has small children at home, right. Mm. And so when you get the earlier the diagnosis, the good news is we have more options, but it also means we're playing a little bit that crystal ball that I'm looking for that tells me what's going to be the outcome, so what's going to be the best planning method. That can be really challenging. So whatever plan we do, we want to make sure it has appropriate flexibility. I primarily work, again, with the Medicaid statutes. Mm-hmm. But if I deal with somebody who's older, usually I also have veterans benefit statutes, and there's always the tax laws out here. And so you're dealing, as well as trust and estate laws, and so you're dealing with a whole bunch of different laws, a whole bunch of different regulations. And by the way, they don't play nicely together. They were not, the veterans benefits regulations were not designed to address Medicaid issues. The IRS really doesn't care what Medicaid wants. And Medicaid doesn't care whether or not you have to pay taxes on capital gains or whatever else we might do as part of the planning. So when you sit down, you're also dealing with all these different areas of law and trying to figure out which one's the best and do the analysis as to what the impact is going to be on these other areas. So there's a lot of balancing involved as well. Again, in a crisis situation, we have that direct line. We know what has to happen. When we've got planning options, we're going to do our best guess and allow for that flexibility.
That's a different way of looking at it. I like that.
Well, yeah, that's what we have to do with our client, give them those options and let them know what the impact is going to be if the plan changes.
Now tell me, if people already have limited income and resources, why would they need to seek an elder law attorney?
Because you can have limited income and resources, and this is something I think people don't quite understand. If you don't own things the way Medicaid would like you to own them, you can have very little in your bank. You can have very little that's countable, but you're still not going to qualify for Medicaid.
Right.
And we actually, again, particularly we see that in younger individuals who end up, unfortunately, in nursing home or requiring Medicaid. That nursing homes actually have the ability to apply for Medicaid on somebody's behalf, and that person may or may not be aware that application's going through.
Right.
A real common issue is going to be a retirement account, for example. Retirement accounts are not always, they can be counted differently by Medicaid. And one way, if you do one thing with retirement account, it's exempt. If you don't do anything, it's considered countable and it can be disqualifying for Medicaid purposes. And the reason I give that as an example is that most people, when they're younger, their retirement account's just sitting there.
Right.
So it's going to be disqualifying, whereas we can do something very simple, put it in payout status, and suddenly it's an exempt resource and this person will qualify for Medicaid. So you may not have a lot, but if you don't own it the way Medicaid wants you to own it or the VA wants you to own it, you're not getting those benefits.
And nobody knows that. I mean, they would need the attorney to, because that's what you do.
Right, exactly. And on the back end, what other people don't realize is that there is something called estate recovery in Medicaid. Medicaid's actually a pretty good deal when you think about it, because Medicaid pays the nursing home a rate for daily care that you and I are not, we could not negotiate on our own because it's not particularly a favorable rate for the nursing home. So you get a really good rate for care that you couldn't afford. And let's say you either leave the nursing home. I have had clients who do leave nursing homes, or you pass. Then Medicaid's going to look and say, well, look, we gave you this really good rate. We paid for care that you could not otherwise afford. And you died and you left money in your estate that would cover what we spent, and we'd like to get reimbursed. So it's really kind of an interest-free loan from the government, if you think about it.
Wow.
It's not a bad rate, but most people would rather not have to pay it. They may not have the resources at the end at the end of their life to pay for it, or they have just enough for, you know, let's face it, our parents work pretty hard. They would like to leave their family a benefit more than the government, even though the government did provide them with this benefit. So we do what's called, that process of getting back the money they spend is called estate recovery. Again, without that planning, you may not realize that estate recovery is coming, or you may find that that family house that's been in your, you know, that's been in your family for generations is now subject to a Medicaid lien. So again, you want to go to your attorney and make sure that there's no surprises that at their funeral, that you don't just have funeral expenses, but also a huge bill for Medicaid that you now have to deal with.
Well, right. They can pursue that retroactively.
Well, it's not really in effect. It's on that person's death when they no longer need that benefit.
Wow. But isn't it already been paid as they go, right?
Medicaid has paid as you go. Essentially, the way it works is that you're going to pay your income. Let's say the nursing home rate, I'm making up these figures. Let's say it's $4,000 a month.
Right.
I get $1,000 in Social Security a month. Now, there's some deductions that they're going to take out of mine, but again, I'm using even numbers. So I'm going to pay my $1,000 to the nursing home, and Medicaid's going to pay its $3,000. Now I leave the nursing home. I get better, again, or I pass. Medicaid's going to look, and if I have more than $25,000 in my estate, they're going to say, well, you know, Ms. Weinberg, you had, or we gave your mother, you know, 10 months of nursing home care. We paid $30,000 a month so that she could receive this care. You have a house worth $100,000 with equity. We'd like our $30,000 back. Thank you.
Wow. So, Diane, changing topics a little bit, we all get those alerts on our phone and we hear the announcements about, you know, parents who have Alzheimer's disease or dementia, they've gone missing, you know, those alerts. So how can an elder law attorney assist in that situation? Or
That's a great one. Actually, I don't know if you just saw, there was one that announcement that just came out in Dunwoody, I want to say, in the last 3 days about a woman with Alzheimer's who just went missing. And I haven't followed up to see where she is. Dementia, this is when you do have somebody who's got dementia. And I always say dementia is the game changer. I don't care how well you've planned. You could have gone to the best. And we've seen this in our practice. Morgan and DeSalvo traditionally is a trust and estate firm. And as you mentioned, it's one of the best in the country, according to U.S. News and World Reports. We're very, very proud of that. But you can have a really fabulous estate plan. You can have the best fiduciaries protecting your interests. But once you have dementia, your world has changed significantly. And I don't care how good the rest of your planning is. We can usually deal, a good financial plan we can usually deal with, but it's that living. It's that, and you probably saw this when you worked in life insurance as well. You see these people who no longer can provide for themselves. And that's when we start getting into issues, not just of Medicaid and planning and veterans benefit planning, but we're really talking about potentially guardianships and conservatorships. And in Georgia, this is an area, I always describe it as the opposite of your 18th birthday. When you're 18, you wake up with magic powers you didn't have the day before.
Not looking forward to that. My daughter, sorry, go ahead.
Right, but this is the opposite of that. This is a court coming in and saying, you lack capacity to take care of yourself. And I believe the language is, and I think I may need more coffee for this, but I'm gonna go ahead and give it a shot. It's, do you have the capacity to make significant responsible decisions with respect to your health and safety or with respect to the management of your financial affairs?
And who decides that?
The court does. And so we have family members who, again, you have somebody who starts wandering, for example. This is somebody who can't take care of themselves anymore. And they probably haven't been able to for a while, unless there was some kind of traumatic event like a stroke or an injury. This is probably something that's been going on for a while.
Sure.
And so once that person starts leaving the house, sometimes without clothes on, or they leave the house to go take the dog for a walk and can't remember how to get back home. Mm. And so this is where this person can no longer protect themselves. They are very vulnerable. And so we have to get the government involved. We have to get the courts involved to appoint somebody else to provide this person with the protection. A guardianship, they're the same process, but they deal with two different areas of personal rights. The guardianship deals with the person rights. It used to be known mm-hmm. as the guardianship of the person and guardianship of the property. The guardian, you think about it guarding the person. So it deals with issues like residence and domicile. It deals with marriage. Can this person get married? Can this person make healthcare decisions on their own? Can they give consent to medical procedures? And can they hire people to protect, to provide for their healthcare?
Sure.
So these are essentially the rights that the court would remove upon finding that this person lacks capacity.
Mm-hmm.
And conservatorship deals with all those financial aspects, check writing, business management, anything that you would be able to financially do on your own. Do you have the capacity to make a contract of any type? So again, the court would remove that and appoint somebody, typically a family member, but not always. And there are even what they call county guardians and county conservators for people who really don't have a lot of family members or other support groups to help them, or maybe they have a lot of family members but no one that the court trusts to take care of this person. And so you would bring in somebody from the county to do that.
Wow. Gosh, that's there's so much detail that goes on. I just couldn't imagine.
It's a pretty
having to face all that.
It is. It's very overwhelming. And I'll get family members in. And also there's a distinction I feel like I need to make. It's not the ability to make bad decisions that will cause somebody to seek a guardianship or conservatorship. Or occasionally I'll get somebody calling about, 85-year-old mom and dad or who have decided to do something. And it's really, it doesn't make any sense. But we all have the ability from the time we're 18 on to legally make really bad decisions, and that's okay. What we're talking about with the guardianship or conservatorship is that inability to process the information. We get information in our brain. We understand what it means. We evaluate it. We think about possible outcomes. And when you start talking about dementia or this lack of capacity, that ability to process the information and understand what the different consequences are, that goes away.
Mm-hmm.
That's impaired. And so that's, again, when the court's going to step in. And there's a variety of processes in place to protect the individual who's subject to the guardianship, potentially subject to a guardianship or conservatorship.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there is a lot of detail in place. And this is by no means the first stop. I would recommend trying to put in a whole series of protections before we get to that point.
Sure.
Because it is removing somebody's rights. It's removing somebody's ability to take care of themselves. So we want to make sure, and the courts take this very seriously, they want to make sure that that individual truly needs protection before they're going to impose a conservatorship or a guardianship.
Now, just to kind of, or to ask one more question, all the detail that you just explained for that probably multiplies when it comes to special needs. Can you tell me a little bit about the special needs planning?
Yes, special needs planning, and yes, there can be a lot of overlap between guardianships and conservatorships.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I mentioned earlier, you've got the autistic child who turns 18.
Right.
This child, depending on their level of understanding, may not be able to make decisions for themselves. They may not understand what a doctor is telling them to do, or they may not understand when somebody comes in and says, sign this document. And you hear some real horror stories about that.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, the guardianship may be part of what we call special needs planning. But it doesn't have to necessarily be a cognitive impairment that causes somebody to do special needs planning. Special needs planning is planning that we do for somebody who's got a disability. And that could be somebody who has just a physical impairment, and we do have clients that have medical conditions which cause physical impairments. I've got one client who mentally is absolutely fine, but she requires assistance with literally every, what they call, activity of daily living. She requires assistance to eat. She requires assistance to groom and to bathe. And literally every aspect of her life, somebody has to help her. But she's a partial business owner. her mind is absolutely fine. And what we find, we have the challenges here because to allow her to work, to allow her to run a daily life is expensive.
Right.
And so the special needs planning we use allows her to have access to public benefits so that it can provide a lot of the support that she needs and help take the a lot of the burden off of her while allowing family members to provide her with support. You can put money into what are called special needs trusts, and Medicaid pretends that that money doesn't exist.
Okay.
So those are very special trusts. They have to comply with federal law.
Sure.
And I get, you occasionally hear about people who say, oh, I can throw a special needs trust together, and they find a form and they throw it together. And that always makes me nervous, yes, because mm-hmm. you run into tax implications, and you also run into the worst risk is having that trust not qualified by Medicaid or by Social Security, and that individual owing a whole bunch of money back to the federal government or to the state government for those benefits. So that's our goal in special needs planning, is to give somebody access to public benefits to help provide for their needs, but allowing them to also have income or savings to provide for those things that public benefits does not take care of.
Gotcha. Wow. Well, I would love to have you back and have you back as well. So will you tell our listeners how they can get in touch with you?
Absolutely. Again, I'm at Morgan and DeSalvo. Our phone number is there at 678-720-0750. We have a lot of information on our website, morgandesalvo.com. We take great pride. I know traditionally when you talk to marketing people, they say, well, only write, 300 words or no more than X amount of words. We actually put a lot of information give a lot of detailed information
That's
on our
great.
Website. We are a resource. We encourage people out to use it. Mm-hmm. You can also contact me through email at dweinberg@morgandesalvo.com. And that's Weinberg, W-E-I-N-B-E-R-G, at Morgan DeSalvo, D as in David, I, S as in Sam, A-L, V as in Victor, O.com. I also have a Twitter handle. It's Weinberg Elder Law, but there's no E. It's W-E-I-N-B-R-G, elderlaw.com.
Thank you so much. I am just so excited.
Yeah, speaking of Twitter, we've been tweeting during the show here. So when I was taking those photos and on my phone, I wasn't like updating my Facebook status or anything. I was so there's been a lot of activity on Twitter for the show here as well. And so you can find it. And also all the content will be on the website for all your contact information. But on a different note, I don't know.
I have the first question.
Okay. Well, I was just going to ask Diana real quick.
No, go ahead.
I know an attorney. Her name is Shelley Elder. I don't know if you know. It's funny being an elder law, but that's her last name is Elder. But I imagine you know a few attorneys. Yeah.
I do. Actually, I don't think I'm a little embarrassed because I don't think I've met Shelley. But but we actually have in Atlanta, and we have a fabulous group of elder law attorneys, and we have been absolutely wonderful resources for each other, and helping the community grow. The community, and this is one of the things I like, again, in my previous life, I was a litigator, and I still do some litigation, particularly in the guardianship context, but the community is out there to help people.
Mm-hmm.
We like our hugs from our clients. We like that we can take somebody who can't live at home and find them a program that will help provide them for support in their house or help allow their spouse to live and have financial security when the other spouse goes into a nursing home and passes. So they're very committed, and it's a wonderful community to work with.
Mm. Well, you may not know Shelley Elder because she's not actually an elder law. Her last name is Elder.
Okay.
She's actually in real estate and business planning.
Okay, well, good. Then I feel a little better.
Exactly. Yeah. But speaking of that, I did have a question like for both of our guests here. As like for up-and-coming attorneys, like maybe in your field, what are some... is that your question? Or,
no.
Okay, yeah. What are some things you might advise or tips you might give or whatever to, advice like on the short list? What might you recommend they do to kind of get started?
Elder law, it's a challenging field to get into because the statutes are it's so heavily regulated and there's so many layers to that. That one of the things I recommend, a typical elder law attorney has not started out in elder law. They've started someplace else, and they've moved into elder law as an interest. So I'll tell them the biggest thing you've got to do is you've got to work on your education. I think starting up my first year, I had 80 hours of countable CLE, and that didn't include all the hours that I spent just just with that didn't ha- I didn't get any credit
right,
for.
Right. Right.
So it's really working on that education, mm-hmm. and making sure that you understand the basics of each of these areas. They're all very complex. They're all very detailed. They don't make sense. There's a wonderful Supreme Court opinion out there, and I keep forgetting the quote, but essentially when it talked about the Social Security law, the Supreme Court said, I know the words that you're using, I just don't understand the order that you have them in.
Right.
It didn't make any sense to them. So it's really having to delve in and know that and make sense out of regulations that otherwise don't make sense. And finding a mentor, absolutely mm-hmm. finding somebody that you can work with and making sure that you have somebody you can rely on and bounce ideas off on. Frequently, elder law attorneys work solo or very small firms, and as much as we'd like to bounce ideas and theories off of ourselves, we really need that other person out there.
Or probably, like you said, participate in some of those community events or networking within those organizations
absolutely.
Specific to the industry. Yeah.
Well, and I think just taking people out to lunch, if it's hard at first to find a mentor, I think that young associates, young lawyers would be shocked to find that if you reach out to people, I think Diane would go out to lunch with you. I would go out to lunch
sure.
with you. But it's taking that initial step.
Mm-hmm.
Additionally, it's sometimes, the advice I was given long ago was that when you are new to an area of law, find a new law and become an expert in that one piece. For example, when I was a labor and employment law attorney, the FMLA, the Family Medical Leave Act, had just been enacted. So some partners in the firm said, Sarah, take this on, become the expert in the firm in this area.
Oh, that's great.
And
then it's a niche.
Yes. And one other thing I would suggest, go outside the law. If you're interested in elder law, go to the advocacy groups, the magazines, the AARPs of the world, other groups, and disability issues. Go to the American Kidney Association. Find out philanthropic groups that care about issues for people mm-hmm. who are dealing with this area, who will need legal help.
Become a resource for them, yeah.
And not just a resource, but to learn from them.
Okay.
What do they care about? What obstacles are they facing?
Thanks. I do have a great question. I know, Sarah, that you are a former assistant district attorney in DeKalb County, and we're kind of talking about the emergency calls that we see or hear or that we get. What are things to consider when you get the emergency call? How can you prepare for the 2 a.m. call when a loved one has been hurt, arrested, or in a crisis? Or what, and the legal decisions need to be made. What do you do? And I know you both can speak on this. So Sarah, I'll let you start.
Well, I'll certainly address this from a personal perspective. Mm-hmm. I have gotten those calls, not just from friends, but the 1 a.m. call coming that a loved one is the victim of domestic violence. And it changes things for you when you're trying to give the best legal advice you can give, but you also love this person.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't know if they're going to make it through the night. So I think it's really important for we as attorneys to have our own set of resources. You've got to step back a little bit and give the best advice you can, but also making sure you're in check with others who can give you wise counsel.
Sure.
So I think it's important to be prepared. I think that whether you stay in traditional practice, move into a different area, keep your network of experts, because it's going to help you in the long run to help your loved ones and others who need care.
Because you might not be making the best decision because you're biased over, your loved one.
Well, or you may need to be bedside.
You know,
sometimes your role is to hold the hand
mm-hmm.
and to have somebody else come in. And I'll freely admit that I'm not good at that. I want to hold the hand and also conquer the big obstacles.
Sure.
So finding that balance is important.
Go ahead.
No, actually, I agree very much. It's also hard because I'll get emails from clients and on the weekend, and there's been an emergency, or a text from a client and there's been an emergency. The good news is, for most of what I see, what some people perceive as an emergency, we can go through and we can talk it out, and it's not quite as emergent as they need.
Okay.
So we're able to give sometimes just giving that person perspective. Are they in the hospital? Are they receiving the care that they need? What is your concern? What can we deal with now? What can we do to stabilize the situation?
Sure.
So I haven't fortunately dealt with it as much on the personal side. So I guess that's probably pretty good. I get to deal with it more from that third party side.
Right.
But what absolutely has to be done now? But there are times I have gotten that phone call. I remember one occasion I had a It was during the day, but I had children at home. Mm-hmm. It was a holiday, and I got in the shower, grabbed my kid, and we went off and took mm-hmm. care of the situation. Fortunately, again, most of the time it's not a true emergency, and we're able at least to get the situation stable and then make our good planning from there.
Great. Did you want
to? Just to Diana, not really a question, but just. You know, you mentioned early on about elder law versus it. Really, the better term really is, why can't it just be called long-term care law? Right? Is there a movement to create that, or can we start that now? Or yeah.
I am all for starting that now. Yeah. I used to describe myself as a disability attorney, and you had Sarah Kaki, who I adore, mm-hmm. and she's a fabulous attorney. And you know, but that was the phone calls I would get. I would get people who need SSDI yeah. work, and that's I do not do that. I call Sarah for that. Right. But it really should be long-term care law. I think about 40 years ago, 35, 40 years ago, it was coined as elder law because that's where people, that's
typically, yeah.
Well, that's maybe where most of the people saw it. And you saw, I mean, this is a newer practice area. It didn't exist in Georgia, I want to say, until 25, 30 years ago, if that long ago. Mm-hmm. And it's been a newer area of law really across the country. So you saw the attorneys that first moved into this area, they were assisting elderly parents sure. and elderly relatives. Who many of whom they were trusted estate attorneys, but they were getting phone calls from family members saying, "What do I do? I need to put mom in a nursing home. You know, Aunt Jane has to go here," and that's how the area developed. About 10 years ago, the National Academy of Elder Law Attorneys. I was at a conference, and I want to say it was in D.C., where they announced that that we were also special need planners as well.
But is there a more encompassing term that's been
not
tossed
yet,
around,
no.
or just a long term?
No,
is
I mean,
probably the best. But
so most of the time now, I was going to say that was the transition from elder law to and special need planning attorneys. And you do yeah. see people who kind of some who work more with seniors, some who work more with children with disabilities or adults with disabilities. But you're right; it really should be long term care planning attorney.
Yeah, that's probably the best umbrella that would cover all those topics. Mm-hmm. You mentioned, I would think, just from a layman's standpoint, yeah.
We can start the movement today. I'm okay.
Okay, it's official, yeah.
Right
do we,
here.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Yeah. Motion carries. I don't know if that's legal or legit, but yeah, we'll start with there. Back to Sarah, just another question. On a hot topic issue that's in the news recently, right? You were talking about the NFL and some great news last night, but more recently, these issues, we don't normally get into controversial topics, but you can't deny the what's going on and potentially what could, you know, how could we move the ball forward? No pun intended, but
nice. That was very nice.
Right. But with the NFL, Ray Rice, I mean, and I was watching the game, the FSU alumni FSU and Jameis Winston. I mean, these are serious issues, and they've been just somehow pushed aside and not brought to the forefront. Now they are. So, I mean, you know, is there is this Monday morning quarterbacking or I mean, is there something we can that can proactively to make changes on these topics or these issues?
Absolutely. And I think that what we need to do is to start with our own backyard, you know, to use that football analogy. Right. Let's play ball in our lot.
Right.
And so let's deal with these issues of domestic violence. Let's deal with these issues of respect for women and children, thinking about what we can do in our own community. I mean, the dialogue is very important. It is critical that we're talking about it. It is critical that there is questioning
right.
and healing. But wouldn't it be something if we take that and decide within our own community, we can do some things to change? And, you know, at the very least, sometimes I talk a lot to folks about the fact that, all right, this is going to be a strange analogy, but Bill Murray, a few weeks ago at the Toronto Film Festival,
right.
there was Bill Murray Day.
Yeah.
And one of the great quotes from Bill Murray is he talks a lot about how he has dealt his whole life with loneliness. And so when I talk to folks, I talk to the fact about, have you ever been in a crowded room and felt totally alone?
Mm-hmm.
The answer is a resounding yes.
Mm-hmm.
So if you take that concept and take it to domestic abuse, if you take it to children needing care, parents needing to be empowered to be in better parents, lawyers needing to deal with ethical issues, me calling my new brilliant friend sitting next to me here at Buckhead Business Radio X, you know, I have been there quietly dealing with a dear father of mine who had dialysis onset dementia. And that's a tough thing when this man you love, this beacon in your life, should not be driving anymore.
Mm-hmm.
What a godsend to have now of an open dialogue of somebody to talk to about that issue. You know, the laws aren't there to help you deal with those kind of things, when to take the car keys.
Right.
But it's causing the change. So that was a long answer to your question, but I think we need to act.
But I think a kind of another, let's say analogy, but evolution is back in the day, it used to be a very stigma to have alcohol issues, whatever, celebrities or high profile people. And it was Betty Ford that had those issues. She stepped up, created the center. And now it's not the stigma for whether it's the average civilian or a celebrity or some high profile person to admit, raise their hand and say, I need help. So in terms of domestic violence, I mean, if there's anything to good come out of this, of all the going on with professional athletes and these issues that, you know, they have this issue of domestic violence and no one really is held accountable for it. Right.
Right.
Whether the organization or the individual, and it's and from the victim standpoint, they have that kind of stigma. It's like, I don't want to, you know, raise my hand or, but now they kind of have the ability to do that. Right.
Yes, and a wonderful way to begin, whether it's domestic violence or, let's not forget, Robin Williams, a mental health issue,
man,
that any one of us could face, a genetic issue we can't control, but yet, you know, we didn't choose, but yet we can get help from. Mm-hmm. One way to start that healing is to simply say, how are you? And allow them to answer the question. Deciding from now on, we're not going to give the, you know, proverbial,
good.
Fine,
right,
yes,
right,
yes,
yeah,
yeah. Fine, move on. No, look them in the eye, put your phone down. Yeah. And
right.
Say, how are you? And wait for a response and dive in.
That's awesome. Yeah. Yeah, I always get from my kids, good. How was school today? Good. I have one more question. Speaking of kids, both of you have kids, and I have two myself, and we stopped at two because my second one was so much fun. And to have three and four and also be professional career women in the law, you know, lawyers and everything that you guys have done, or girls, have done. Tell me some challenges and just tell me how you balance all that, and how, to the person that's listening, and I know we have a lot of women that listen that are attorneys, you know, just elaborate.
Thank you. We actually ended up getting help. I have an au pair who lives in the house, and we did that about a year and a half ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's two things. First of all, it's recognizing the fact that we can't do it all.
Mm.
When people talk about balance, and occasionally I'll have somebody say, wow, you've got great balance. I said, I don't have balance. I have priorities. and sometimes that's what it is. Sometimes it is the fire that's burning the greatest at that particular moment.
Sure.
But it's recognizing that we need help and figuring out that solution of how you're going to do it.
Like I just told my husband the other day that I definitely need a maid.
Yes, yes. And I mean, we've got the world's most wonderful au pair. I hope she said she wanted to listen to this later on today, so hopefully she'll. But she's wonderful, and she takes the kids. She makes sure that they are able to do their afternoon activities. She'll set up play mm-hmm. dates, because I was always the worst about setting up play dates, and now they actually they can go to their activities. They can see their friends. I can focus on my work,
mm-hmm.
and it's also setting those boundaries, which can be difficult, which is that mm-hmm. when I go home at the end of the day, I'm not working.
Right.
I'm focused on my kids, and sometimes that can't happen. Sometimes I do have, in my practice, a legitimate emergency. We have an emergency guardianship. I have to go to court. Somebody is missing. There has been some kind of crisis, and I do
sure.
actually have to go and be with the client after hours.
Right.
But for the most part, we're able to. I'm able to go home, deal with my family. My clients have that expectation that they can always reach me in an emergency, because I'm email obsessed, and so they can always send me an email, and I will always get it. And if it's an emergency, legitimately, I will get back to them immediately. But I don't think you can talk about work-life balance. I think it really is developing those priorities, finding the help that you need, and
creating the borders.
And creating those borders that you're able to work with.
Thank you. That's a great answer. Sarah?
I think embrace that there is no balance, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. Each day brings its own set of rewards, its mm-hmm. own set of challenges, and just know that today's needs are going to be taken care of. And I don't say that lightly. You know, a pastor once said to me years ago, Sarah, you know, all of us have so many balls in the air. You just have to determine which balls are glass. Those are the ones you can't drop, and everything right. else you can probably let go of.
Mm-hmm.
And so to do that, I think it's really important to give yourself grace and to give others grace. And, you know, we tend to get caught up in the stress, accountability in ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
Why did she do that? Not let mm-hmm. it go. Let it go. And you know, for me, I will say, and so this is especially to anybody out there who has not found the love of their life, I did marry my high school sweetheart. I have the bad prom pictures to prove it. but I have a partnership marriage. Sure. I have a guy who is in this all in with me. Uh-huh. And so it doesn't mean that every day is easy. Let's face it, getting here today on time was hard. but to have that person at night who says, oh my gosh, we did it. We did it.
That's awesome.
Everything. And that makes it worth it on the journey.
Sure. Wow, that's awesome. I got nothing. I'm done. This was so much goodness that I just have to reflect on it.
Yeah. Well, it was a phenomenal show.
Yeah.
Great information, takeaways, and interesting conversation with compelling stories, right?
Yes, and just want to invite everybody to listen again next week. We have some great guests coming up next Tuesday morning, 8 o'clock. If not, you can always listen afterwards.
And I'm getting replaced by a new co-host next week, right? Or fill in, or guest co-host, or something's
in
the works.
Yeah,
stay tuned for that.
Yeah. So thank you so much for listening. This is Emily Rowell with Peachtree Offices and Atlanta Legal Experts. You can hear all of our shows on atlantalegalexperts.com. Emily Rowell signing out.